Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. Joining Francine as co-host this evening is cancer survivor Peter LaMoth, and they continue their series of survivor stories with Beth Connerly, a breast cancer survivor. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about your diagnosis of cancer.
Yes, glad to. I was diagnosed with stage 1 non-metastatic invasive ductal carcinoma with lobular features after I detected a hard lump in the side of my rib cage. I had it looked at, it was biopsied, and that was the diagnosis.
And Beth, I'm interested by your description of your cancer, 5 or 6 words thrown in together. Did you understand any of those words before you were diagnosed?
No, I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a clue. So it was a huge learning curve, straight up.
What was your initial reaction when you found out that you had cancer?
My initial reaction was, oh my gosh, you know, my children who were then 8.5 and 7, my husband, my family. I was very, very nervous for myself.
So, Beth, did you notice this lump for a little while, or did it just pop up all of a sudden?
I happened to be on the phone with my sister, and I was balancing the phone with my arm crossed across my chest and felt it. And it was a hard pea-sized thing, so I had it looked at right away.
Was it your impression right away that this could be cancer?
Yes.
And had you had a family history of cancer, or was there any other reason that you were worried about cancer at that point in time?
My maternal aunt at this point in time, my mother's sister had breast cancer, and she had had a radical mastectomy with no other treatment and had lived.
So you have this lump, you went to the doctor, and they obviously thought it was suspicious.
Mm-hmm. So then I went for another mammogram, a diagnostic mammogram, and the radiologist came out to see me. Which wasn't always the case. Typically, I dealt with a technician. And she said, this looks like it's something we need to biopsy. And I was terrified.
And how long did it take to actually get the diagnosis?
About 1.5 weeks.
So that's a very short time for a very big diagnosis like that.
Yes.
And I know, Peter, that you've also been through this. Either one of you, can you tell me what goes through your mind when you hear that word?
Gosh, for me it was enormously overwhelming, and I think Beth, you would agree. Perhaps
Absolutely.
You felt like you'd fallen off a cliff,
yes.
And that you were in a free fall, and you had no idea when that free fall was going to end.
Absolutely, and I remember the day. It was a beautiful April day, April 21st in 08, and I went out on my back steps to take the call because my mother was inside. She's elderly and didn't want her to hear what we were talking about. And after I got the diagnosis that it was cancer from my breast surgeon, I went into business mode. It was the only way my brain could handle it. I had to get a piece of paper and a pen and write everything down and ask lots of questions.
One of the questions and issues I've heard from patients is that they don't actually like to get a diagnosis like that over the phone. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a toss-up between finding out as soon as possible versus being told in a setting where perhaps you can have a support person with you.
Absolutely.
What's your feeling about that?
Well, I chose the phone. I'm an proactive person. And I asked Dr. Gruby, she said, would you prefer to hear by phone or have you come in? And I would just worry all the way in from Guilford if I did that.
So, Beth, when you say that you went into business mode immediately afterwards, what did that entail? What type of things did you...
That entailed asking lots of questions about what would come, the statistics for women my age with this stage of cancer. It entailed for me trying to figure out exactly what the next steps would be. And my doctor spent a very long time, gave me her mobile number, and we talked it all through.
When you went for that first appointment, did you go by yourself?
For the first appointment after my diagnosis? Yes, I did not. No, I did not go by myself. My husband came with me, and I'd been advised to always bring someone with me and to also bring pad and paper and take notes, and I wholeheartedly recommend that to everyone that I know.
How do you actually break this news, say, to your husband? You found out, and I guess your mother was home.
Yeah.
So how do you break the news to family members? That must be a very, very difficult thing.
It's really challenging because you are going through, the cancer patient is going through something already that you don't even understand. I think I kind of just blurted it out to my husband. I called him at work, actually got him on the phone, and said, I just got my results, and it's cancer.
Beth, many people think that cancer only affects the person who's diagnosed, but it certainly affects their family members, their loved ones, coworkers, and friends. Can you say a little bit about how your family responded, how your friends responded when they found out?
Well, my husband told his office that he needed to leave and came home immediately. And he was a brick, maybe too much of a brick, because that's another role that sometimes spouses go into, is not getting enough for themselves by taking care of you. He came home, we talked it over, we decided we wouldn't tell the children until we had a plan, and he said, what can I do for you? And it was a gorgeous day, and I have two big Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and I said, I need to go for a hike, get the kids off the bus. We then waited about 3 weeks while we went through all of the processes of getting an MRI, which found another tumor, and a second tumor in the same breast on the left side. And at that point in time, we kind of tried to keep it as much away from the children as possible. Lots of doctor's appointments, wonderful team at Yale that we assembled. And we told my children, I'll never forget, on a Friday night, after having sushi in our kitchen, before Mother's Day. And that was probably the thing that bothered me the most, was having to tell my children.
Can you tell us again how old your children were?
My children were at the time, let's see, about 7 and 8 and a half, roughly.
So that's a very tough message for children that young.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And we knew people who had had breast cancer. And we know people who have had repeated breast cancer recurrence, but not personal friends of ours, so they never had been kind of in the inner sanctum of it.
So that was a question I had, which is, did you at any point in time talk to anybody, any of your caregivers, about how you convey that kind of a message to young children?
Yes, I did.
Is that something that you think that we need to be doing more about on our part as the physicians and as the healthcare institutions to help women and men in this position to convey those kinds of messages?
Absolutely. I think we can't be too over-prepared for something like that. It rocks a child's world. At the exact moment when you need support, you're giving support to your children.
Exactly. So it sounds like this has been a very difficult time. The first couple of weeks you were, say, in business mode.
Yes.
When did
yes.
you switch over and actually sit down and think about what was going on with you?
I would say the week after. My husband had participated in the PanMass Challenge, which you may or may not have heard of, raising $30 million plus for cancer for years prior to my diagnosis, for a good friend named Sue who had leukemia and lymphoma. And the first thing he did was call Billy Starr up in Boston, who's associated with Dana-Farber, and Billy immediately sent back and said, get this wonderful book, and now I'm blanking on the author, of course, must be that Famara brain we talked about, but I worked through reading that, looking at Dr. Love's breast book, and then I really focused on getting the right team. I wanted doctors who looked me in the eye, told me directly what was happening with me, and yet were compassionate, so it's a tall order.
In that whole process of going through the diagnosis and the workup,
yes.
How many different doctors did you meet?
The first day at Yale, we met with the Breast Center in the old building, and then they had us meet with just preliminarily a medical oncologist, and then we met with a social worker, and I'm trying to think of who else we met with. We had one other doctor at that time. Dr. Higgins was scheduled for us as well, who is my radiation oncologist. I didn't even know there were two kinds of oncologists at the time.
And what did that team of physicians and caregivers tell you to expect? And what would be coming down the line for you and your family?
Well, we hadn't at that moment discovered the second tumor, and so I was told I could probably have a lumpectomy. I was a small-breasted woman. It might deform my breast. I may have to go for mastectomy as well. Bilateral was not even mentioned, but it was in the back of my head. And then the doctors basically said to me, you know, you it's not definite, but you will likely have chemotherapy. And so I went about finding a different medical oncologist that I really liked and ended up with Dr. Lindsay Harris, who's phenomenal.
When they mentioned that word chemotherapy, was that the scariest word that you heard?
I think cancer was scarier than chemo.
Okay.
I have a warrior spirit. The name of my business is Artemis Design, and
okay.
I am one of those kind of let's push through it and get through it good and bad, which we can talk about later. You don't really face what you're going through.
Had you had previous experience with chemotherapy through any of your family or friends?
I had a friend who had breast cancer probably 15 years ago in Boston, who went to Brigham and Women's, and I sat with her through some chemotherapy, and my father had radiation, but not chemotherapy.
Beth, we talked a little bit about how you went into business mode and began to communicate to friends and family, and I'm curious to know if people that you know had cancer and stepped forward, or people in many cases who you didn't know had cancer stepped forward to say, I know what this is like, I can help you, and what type of sort of support network you began to build or began to form around you at the onset.
People were just amazing. The folks who stepped forward for me, is it all right to mention some names?
Absolutely.
Rose Chardello, who's just an amazing person, lives in my town just a couple streets over, and our children know one another. Melissa Burns, who's moved to Atlanta, but who had an In the Pink group out of Guilford, Connecticut, helped out. A friend of mine was diagnosed around the same time I was, and our children went to school together. I think there were four of us in kerchiefs at Calvin Leet School in Guilford at the same time due to chemotherapy.
You know, I've heard this story from multiple women that they had no idea how many women out there had breast cancer until they had a diagnosis, and all of a sudden, all these people just come out of the woodwork.
Yes, they do. And folks that didn't talk about it in years past, now we're talking about it, which I think is wonderful because you need that support.
I think you do, especially from people who've had a similar experience, because it's enormously difficult for people who haven't to say the right things or to feel that they should be stepping forward to help you when oftentimes people think it's a very personal disease. I think people who are affected by cancer suddenly become very open and inclusive of lots of people to help them.
Absolutely. And what was also really helpful were my children saw other women surviving. And I have since taken on that position for friends of mine. Leslie Hyman, a friend, was diagnosed just as I finished my radiation process at the end of 2008. Was diagnosed with cancer as well, breast cancer. And her kids could see me moving on and working through these things. And it was so good, she told me on and on, that to have that available to her children. Also, a friend of mine that I met, we happened to be probably on the surgical gurneys at the same time when I had my bilateral and reconstructive surgery, that big 10-hour, 12-hour one, with Drs. Grubey and Dr. Fusi. We met in Dr. Fusi's office. She had a different surgeon, but she had the same plastic surgeon. And neither of us would ever have been in a plastic surgeon's office, so that's a very strange place to be. But we were there. We met. She had that kind of warrior spirit as well. And we hit it off, and we started calling each other our bosom buddies. And it was really helpful.
You talked a little bit about what your children saw and having the other children see you basically come through this. When you were being treated, what did your children actually see? Did you try to hide the effects of the treatment from the children?
Or I didn't hide anything from my children. I was wide open, unlike some of my friends, and it's certainly a very personal decision. You know, I shuddered to show them my reconstruction and the surgery, because with four drains, and I had them for 45 days, my drains, because I had several infections. That is just an ugly thing for a child to have to see. But they were young enough at the time that I thought if I showed them, I'm doing okay with this, and I can still function as a mom most of the time and do this, then that's a better thing for them to see than to be shielded.
Can you talk about what treatment you got? You mentioned surgery. Can you talk about the other aspects of your treatment?
Yes. I had six surgeries, as it turns out. I had one for the bilateral, which Dr. Grubey very, very much in hand tried to tell me the other breast is prophylactic, and I had a bad feeling about it. And so I had a bilateral surgery and reconstruction. The other therapies that I had were chemotherapy, and I had Taxotere Cytoxin. I only had to have four treatments at the Long Wharf facility. Everyone was wonderful. The most difficult thing was I came out of my bilateral mastectomy, which was in June, and then I, 3 weeks later, started chemotherapy. And then I got an infection that was encapsulated, Dr. Fusi thought. So I ended up having surgery at midnight with Dr. Fusi at Yale, taking everything out. And at the time, I was in the hospital 5 days after for massive doses of antibiotics. My hair started falling out. And I kind of had this idea, concept, because it was ground I hadn't gone over, that it was going to kind of fall off on the pillow like it started to do. Well, it does that at first, as you probably know, Peter. And then one day I decided I was well enough to wash it, And a whole gob of hair just fell right out of my head, just released from the hair follicles. And I felt like a freak.
Do you think that the medical folks didn't prepare you well enough for how that hair loss was going to happen?
I think we could tell people more. Mm-hmm. I think they don't want to scare you. Mm-hmm. And I had done a lot of reading and was up on a lot of things. But I think there's nothing really that can prepare you unless someone says, see this gob of hair, and grabs your hair and says, this is all going to fall out all at once. Uh-huh. And even then, you're probably not prepared.
Right. Was that a big shock for your children?
Yes. A very big shock. My husband and my son Sam decided to shave their heads. And my daughter wore a kerchief for a while. I had gone out and gotten wigs ahead of time. And I got one really sexy long wig for fun. And then I got one that looked like mommy, because that's what my daughter wanted. It's really challenging for the kids.
Well, I can tell everybody in the audience that Beth's hair looks absolutely beautiful, blonde. It grew back really well. It was blonde before?
No, it was getting blonder as I got older.
Okay.
But it grew back black with all gray shot through it. And once I could, I decided to go ahead and change that again.
Absolutely, go for it.
And very tight, what do you call it, corkscrew curls. Uh-huh. And I had a little bit of wave.
Uh-huh. So. Beth, you certainly have a terrific spirit, and it's clear that you applied some humor to the cancer experience. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the ups and downs of the journey and how important there are things are to getting well that aren't necessarily medical?
Right. Well, I was having some back issues from the pulling and tugging of the reconstruction and the drains and all of that. So I used a combination of physical therapy. A woman named Donna Segneri at Integrative Physical Therapy helped me, and Malton Chiropractic helped me, and I did some Reiki.
Terrific. Right? Beth, after the break, let's come back to that. We're going to take a short break now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to hear more about Beth's story of survivorship.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer. And in Connecticut alone, there will be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking. And quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they have ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery at Yale Cancer Center is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Peter Lamoth, and we are joined today by Beth Connerly, and we are discussing her story of survivorship. Beth, before the break, we were talking a little bit about alternative medicine, complementary therapies, and other ways for cancer patients to get better during their cancer experience. Can you say more about your experience?
Absolutely. As we've said, I've gone through many surgeries, resurgeries, reconstruction, chemotherapy, and radiation. And that's a lot for a body to handle. I found in the year after the 2009, within the first year of completing my diagnosis, that I really needed some complementary medicine. I needed some Reiki to kind of pull things together and calm me down and help me heal, because infection is very prominent. I also needed some back adjustments and neck adjustments from all of the different positioning and sutures and drains that had been in my body. And Malton Family Chiropractic helped me there in Guilford. Integrative physical therapy, I started to go because I had tissue contracture that was likened to taking your pointer finger and putting it in a saran wrap and twisting it. That's what happens when you have radiation. And I couldn't raise my arm. I was very limited. And it started to pull through the fascia system of the body, my hip, my knee, and Donna Segneri, who is dedicating herself to helping especially breast cancer patients. She was another huge help to me.
Beth, how hard is it for a cancer patient to find these alternative services?
Well, I think it's harder than it needs to be. I have a dream in my head to get the word out through some sort of website that people can access, or partnering with Yale Cancer Center or with Smilo, with doctors that I know, to help with a list of things that you can do.
In fact, one of the major areas of focus for the American Society for Clinical Oncology is looking at these complementary care issues and ways for patients to access those. So hopefully in the future we'll see some grant money going in that direction as well to help to develop those programs.
That would be fantastic. And just to add, I kind of put exercise in a complementary therapy bin. I, as I said, have two dogs, love to walk my dogs. So whenever I could manage them, I would walk. I also have a dear friend, Joy Scott, who has Body in Motion in Guilford again, and she teaches Pilates and has yoga and all of those things, and that was just fantastic therapy for my body.
What about diet? A lot of patients ask questions about supplements, herbal medicine, what kind of dietary interventions they should be taking while they're getting chemotherapy. Did you get into that area at all?
A little bit. I was told I was estrogen positive and progesterone positive for my tumors, and my doctor recommended that I not do melatonin because it can mimic estrogen. So I'll tell you, there are things that you shouldn't take, as you likely know. I did try to eat well with fresh fruits and vegetables, cauliflower, broccoli. The cruciferous vegetables seem to be really high on the list of helping, and I did really try to drink lots of milk and lots of water to flush the toxins from my system. Those are kind of the protocol I used.
Yeah, I think with diet, of course, goes exercise. And Can you say a little bit about, I mean, you look like you're very physically fit and very active. Is that something you also use to combat the disease?
Yes, I started very physically fit and active. I've always been that way. And it was for my brain as much as for my body. I really, really needed to do this. One thing that really helped me along, a woman named Siobhan Thompson through a Livestrong grant with the Yale School of Nursing, they have an exercise intervention trial going on. It's called Yale Fit. And I was selected as part of the study. We exercised 3 times a week with a trainer for 6 months, 40 minutes of cardio, leg machines, and sit-ups. And I happened to be randomized with my best friend, Leslie. And it was just a sheer pleasure to work with the trainers. And Siobhan is just an amazing person. Keeps us going.
So, Beth, in the recovery phase, now that you're a couple of years out from cancer, are you continuing that exercise program?
I am. I have to say, though, Dr. Foss, that there's a fallout for me after cancer, and I know I'm not the only one. I'm sure you've had patients that have this. You have to adjust to the new normal. So I am following a regimen of exercise, and I'm still in the Yale Fit program, although I don't have the trainer. I have had numerous injuries. I had to have a brain scan because of something that happened with fear of metastases in my brain when I didn't pass certain tests. I've had a bone scan to check on things, and just today I was with Dr. Radebold, my internist, going over a possible compression fracture in my heel, tendonitis and plantar fasciitis, which Femara can cause some, you know, fractures. It can up your chances. So getting used to this new normal is a whole category that I think it is under-addressed.
And just to let the audience know, how long will you be on the Femara?
I started on tamoxifen, and then I moved to an aromatase inhibitor. And I typically it's 5 to 10 years. We have originally discussed 5 years of some kind of combined adjuvant therapy, another new word I learned, after the other big therapies of chemo and radiation.
Beth, what you just said reminded me of what we often hear, or what cancer patients often hear, which is that you can be cancer-free but not free from cancer.
Very well put, yes.
And I'm curious to know, because I think cancer survivors would agree that there isn't often enough preparation when you go from being a cancer patient to a cancer survivor. And so I'm curious to know what your experience was and what you think healthcare providers could do for cancer patients who face a very favorable outcome.
Well, I think some of us are very good, as was I, at pushing through the treatments and getting through. I think I was mistaken in thinking that everything would go back to how it was afterward, because you don't have time to really think about the future when you're just trying to get through. I know there's a lot of talk right now about the war, you know, fight a good battle, and people are feeling sometimes like, well, maybe I didn't fight hard enough if things don't go the way they did. So I put it as surviving present participle. I think that's a much better term. I think I'm hoping if more of us think of it that way, that perhaps we can become more cohesive with our caregivers and providers at Yale and other hospitals, because I think that you're just not prepared. I still go to doctors and physical therapy, and my eyesight has changed. I've had issues with femora. I had arthralgia so badly that even when I would get up and be able to bend my toes eventually after walking around for a while, and my fingers, that I developed a trigger finger, likely from the femora. I've also had a cognition issue, which we call femora brain, which, you know, it could be menopause because it happens overnight. It could be the treatments. It could be the femora. It could be multitasking. But it really takes your body a long time to heal and a long time to adjust.
Do you see yourself as evolving through this survivorship process? Have you seen yourself change over the last, say, couple months? And what are you looking at in the future?
What I'm, in terms of my...
This evolution of the issues that you've basically experienced since your treatment, do you anticipate that at some point down the road, those are all going to be resolved?
I hope so. I really hope so. I've had a lot of issues, and that's been a really difficult thing to be courageous about and keep moving. I think that they will be resolved. I think I need to be patient, which is not my strong suit. I think the support of others, one of the hardest things when you're finished with your big therapies, your surgery, your chemo, your radiation, is that folks who haven't had cancer don't understand that you're not done. They're so thrilled for you, and they mean it from the bottom of their hearts that you're done, but you're so not done.
I think a lot of people think that you can just move on, as
yes.
if you could leave cancer in your background, and I think, speaking for myself, that cancer will always be in some way a part of who I am.
And for me, you know, it's reaching out to others, helping people selectively. I'm part of a Why Me group through Network of Strength. They may be cutting our funding, which is not a good thing, but that's an opportunity for me to reach out to people and help and also benefit from other people's information. I reach out to individual people. I give my name to different doctors and say, use me, you know, have people get in touch with me selectively and try to help them through the process. A real good friend, Kristen Wall, who I was going to work with my design, was learned of my cancer as one of the first people in town because she was meeting with me. We had set up a meeting, and we were meeting together to talk about business, and I had to tell her I had cancer and couldn't do it because I had to start my therapies right away. She was just diagnosed with cancer almost 2 years to the day after mine, and so reaching out to her has been very helpful on both sides.
Can you talk about the fear word? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's a major issue for cancer survivors, is the underlying fear that the cancer is going to come back or that something else is going to happen. Mm-hmm. How do you really overcome that?
It's very hard to overcome. I was, at the time that I was being contacted about doing this segment with you, I had found a lump driving my son back from soccer. Just something told me, reach under your left armpit. So I did. I listen to these voices now. And people have strange stories in those ways. Maybe you do too, Peter. Mm-hmm. And there it was, big lump under my left armpit. I was able to get in to see Dr. Gruby, who did a thorough exam, and then I waited for several hours to be ultrasound tested and imaged, and everything worked out fine. It's scar tissue because I've had so many surgeries. But that kind of blip just rocks your world, to use my kid's phrase. You know, it just, you think, okay, you know, you're brushing your hair one moment, and you're thinking, better brush it now, because if I've got to do this again, I will. So I'm scared. I can't really have radiation in that area again. I could do chemotherapy again. I could do surgery again, and I would. I would do everything at the young age of 49 to, you know, to take care of that with young children and my husband and friends and family. But it's terrifying.
That kind of fear, again, is probably something that patients that haven't had cancer don't understand, friends that haven't had cancer. So how do you really get help with that?
Well, this time, taking a cue from my friend Kristen, who's a big Facebook person, I decided to post a little something on Facebook saying, all right, friends, and a big email, I need your help. Found another lump, praying that my son wouldn't check his Facebook for a little while because we weren't telling the children. And please, you know, thoughts, prayers, karma, whatever you believe in. And I had a lot of people kind of, you know, holding my hand from afar and through cyberspace and also in person and calling to make sure things were okay, calling to see if we needed meals, calling to see if we needed any help. And ironically, a friend of mine had just had a deep flap surgery to reconstruct with her own tissue being tunneled up to make a breast. And I was setting up on this wonderful site, lotsofhelpinghands.com, all of her foods and care for her children and all of these things. And so my feeling is, yes, I'm scared, But we have a wonderful community. And if you reach out and you are public, people will come and people will help you. And with 1 in 7 women in Connecticut diagnosed with breast cancer, we really need each other.
That's terrific. Would you say a little bit more about what advice you would give mm-hmm. to people who are going through a cancer experience now or who mm-hmm. are coming out of one and feeling somewhat helpless?
Mm-hmm. It's real easy to isolate yourself. I'm a super outgoing person. I have a wonderful network of friends and family. But at times, I needed to put them at arm's length and use email. So if connect in some way is my first advice. Connect in some way. Don't keep it to yourself. Don't go down in the bunker, as I put it. Try and reach out. Even if it's somebody dropping by a couple times a week or letting someone come with you and help you. I think the most important thing in the beginning is to understand that it's so incredibly overwhelming and to be well-informed, to read, to go to, ask your doctors what websites you should look at. I never got into chat rooms. I never got into any of those things on the internet that can be big danger warning signs. Focus on your own diagnosis, your own recovery, your own team, and then ask for help. Let people bring you things. I was always bringing other people things. And I'll tell you what, those dinners arriving, my kids would run out and say, oh, look who brought dinner, and what is it? You know, put a cooler outside your door, have someone set up a rotation, get help. Get help with your children, because I got infected, we think, because when Dr. Gruby said to me, you need to take it easy, she didn't realize that taking it easy for me was kind of a regular day for a normal person. So you have to let things knit back together. You also need, I think, to somehow connect with another cancer patient. My friend Susan Johnson and I, when we weren't sleeping at night, having surgeries, having infections, would talk to one another on the internet. We'd call each other. We'd support each other. And nobody really understands what you're going through unless they've been through it. They try, and they're well-intended, and they're wonderful people, but I think you're nodding your head, Peter.
I think that's absolutely the case, and I think sometimes, you know, you're worried about taking care of yourself. You also sometimes have to take care of other people who don't know quite how to act around you, and you need to tell them that it's okay, that you can talk about things that don't have to do with cancer, that you want to hear about things in their lives that don't have to do with cancer. You don't have to always be talking about yourself. You can have complete conversations that don't touch on how you're feeling or what you're fearing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I have to say, another thing I think that we need to do to make this easier for women is that we need to make our children more aware of what's happening and what can happen. And in one way that we did this with our children this year during Breast Cancer Month of October was the Killer Kiwis, my daughter's U10 soccer team, and my son's premier U12 team in Guilford, wore pink armbands with pre-wrap and dressed in pink for several games, and really got the awareness out there. And Maisa Abu Khalif, who's also working with Dr. Harris, happened to be another mother on our team of daughter Dina. So Claire, my daughter, and she really got the team involved, and it was wonderful. And we're going to work with Guilford Soccer League next year to do it again.
Beth Connerly is a breast cancer survivor. If you have questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.